Okay, we're still in chapter 1, but it's a new heading on page 12. The position of the soul before any sort of reality. Now, I'm not going to analyze that heading because, just never mind why. I'm just not going to. A bad thing and another worse than the first. So Sharon has not had the opportunity to read this. She asked me today what to read.
Well, I've read all the way through 19.
You've read
but
through.
But I haven't read through page 23.
All right. Okay. Well,
through page 18.
18. Well, that's fine. Yeah, that's fine. Have people had a chance to read it through 18?
I've read it right here. I didn't reread it.
You read through 18 too?
No, I read it. 36.
Further
than
that.
Before last week.
Okay.
I haven't gone through this again this week.
Okay. And how about you, Stephen?
Yeah, I've read
through 18.
Yeah, this past week I read 12 through 23.
Okay. Well, I don't know if we need to. I could focus on the things I've double highlighted, and we could do it that way as we usually do if people want to. I mean, I've kind of gotten a habit of doing that, but since everybody's read it, we don't have to do it that way. What do you think? You want to do
it? What other way would you do it?
In some books that we've done in the past, I just ask people for the things that really stood out for them or things they had questions about that wouldn't serve you very well.
No.
Okay. Each of us is the victim of an inner condition that is something like a labyrinth. Are people all familiar with what a labyrinth is?
I don't know.
Okay. Like a maze or something?
It is. It's like a maze. It's an underground maze. And the labyrinth, I mean, there was a place called the labyrinth and it was on the island of Crete, long before the time of Plato and Aristotle in Athens. So if we were back there in the 4th century before Christ, it would still have been a long time ago. So it was very far back. And it had to do with the story about the Minotaur. The hero Theseus went into the underground labyrinth and was given a ball of thread by the goddess Ariadne. Ariadne is a name that has to do with spiders. Spiders are called arachnids after Ariadne. And the idea is that he would take the ball of thread and he would play it out as he walked into the labyrinth. And when he got to the center, there was a contest between him and the Minotaur. Then after he was successful against the Minotaur, he was still lost in the darkness underground, but he had that thread so he could follow it out, and that's how he escaped the labyrinth. So labyrinth is similar to the kind of video games that people play today, where they go down a corridor and then there's a turn to the right or the left and down another corridor if you had it all diagrammed, that program for the video game, it would be a labyrinth. So the idea here is that each of us has an inner condition that is like that is like a labyrinth, where you can get lost. You can get run into this emotion or that passion and go this way and that way, and eventually you might have difficulty finding your way out. We are led about by different life-changing, life-altering experiences, and all the things that happen to us have a correspondence within us, and that's what creates the labyrinth. A lot of situations that act without much consideration of us, without being under the control of our personality, under our conscious control, without being under the control of our conscious selves. And while we're victims, we're led about by all these dark things and we're unaware of it. So the things that happen to us in life, they become part of this labyrinth, and they're below the level of the conscious. They're a little bit in the subconscious. We might be a little bit aware of them, but then there's that large part of ourselves that we are not aware of. And so patterns that we've had, or mainly as far as what we're looking at here in this book, the ways that we've found of dealing with the difficulties of life, the strategies as far as dealing with others, we're not aware of those for the most part. We might be a little aware, but for the most part, they act on us and move us around without our choosing that it be that way. So that's why we want to become more conscious of all of that sort of thing. We are created uncomplicated, not complex, not complicated, not with labyrinths within us. And for us to live in such a condition, that's bad. But what's worse is we don't know what's happening to us. When we don't know what's going on with us, we're victims of this or the other experience, and we take this condition and this experience for something good. We take it for the treasure of our soul. We identify with it. We think of it as ourselves, the treasure of our life, our existence. These conditions are expressed toward others as well. And since they are bad in themselves, they are therefore expressed in a bad way and can cause harm. Okay. In the middle of page 13, it's a bad thing, then, that the depth of our existence is like a labyrinth, where there are these dark and powerful autonomous forces. Autonomous means self-governing. They're forces that act independently of our conscious choice and will. Dark, autonomous forces sometimes come into collision with one another. Remember, we talked about the possible chaos of collision between these kinds of what are being called autonomous forces or passions, each one self-governing. Passions and desires are interesting that, you know, they develop, they come to a peak, then they're so difficult not to respond to. It just feels like this is something within me that I have got to obey. We may not even have the chance to think about whether or not we want to choose to obey it or not. And it takes hold of us and has a control over us. And if we can hang on and not respond to it, not act on it, all of a sudden it will drop and just disappear. That's the way passions are. Unless we feed them. If we feed them, then they just keep building and building. They can consume us, lead to some kind of terrible self-destroying action. So they have a cycle. There's a cycle of these forces, kind of like the cycles of a storm in nature, where there's like the storm now, Hurricane Matthew. It builds up. When it's over water, it builds up strength. When it goes over land, it does destruction. It's destructive and plays out a little bit and goes out over the ocean again, builds up more, comes in. Eventually, it will play itself out. And passions and desires are a lot like that. So these forces within us, they can collide with each other, shoving one another, acting in such a way that is as if they would like to destroy each other, annihilate one another. And at sometimes they come out in actions. Before we realize it, we've burst out into anger. Don't even know where half of it came from. There might be a trigger, something might touch us off, and then we want to blame whatever that is, but actually it's something that built up inside of us and then just something set it off. And sometimes when we're doing those things, we might even think we're doing something good for another person, doing something that needs to be done. We are then victims of our own dark forces, and others too are victims by our actions, victims of those same dark forces. Also, it's a bad thing when someone has no suspicion at all that something isn't going well inside him. So we want to become more conscious of those things. Bottom of the page, three sentences from the bottom. These things that create this labyrinth, these dark forces, these conditions that are so ugly, work in such a way that they don't let us see them. They are kneaded, kneaded like kneading yeast into dough. They are kneaded into our existence to such a degree that they are kneaded into the natural condition of our soul. And the reason he's saying it that way is because the natural condition of our soul is not to have these dark forces, is not to have the labyrinth. So he's saying these dark forces are kneaded into our soul. They're not part of the natural condition of our soul, but they are kneaded in, worked into the natural condition of our soul to such a degree, and are so united with our life, our self, that we think these conditions are us. While, as a matter of fact, they are completely foreign to our nature, and we can be very defensive on behalf of these things. They are not themselves the nature of the soul. This psychopathological, in other words, psycho-soul pathology, something is wrong, something is sick, the sick soul, dark condition of the soul, these dark conditions that are the result of the fall, of sin, of having been cut off by choices of that which is other than God or goes against God, have no real foundation of their own. Now, part of what he's saying here is a traditional thing that Orthodox believe and teach and understand, that evil has no foundation or existence of its own. It comes about because of the fact that human beings are free. God does not force us to choose him. But if we choose against him, things get all fouled up. But there's no real foundation for the way things are when they're fouled up. They're just fouled up because we've turned away from God, and doing that messes things up in the natural condition of the soul. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. You know, anybody else?
No.
Makes sense? Okay.
What is fouling them up, as you say?
What is what?
What is the fouling, or what is the word you said? Like stirring them up?
Fouling them.
Fouling, getting them all fouled up? If you cast your fishing line and there's something happens and you know it stops, the lure doesn't go into the water right, something gets caught, and then you can end up with a not huge mess in your line, all tangled up, you know, all fouled up, so that the action you intended was not completed. Instead, you have this big tangle. Things get all tangled up. So that's what I'm saying. When we sin, things get all tangled up inside of us. There is this tangled condition, a pathological condition of the soul, not a natural condition. It's ultimately, at the beginning, the result of the fall, but it can happen in our own life. We can experience it by doing something that is wrong, that is immoral. We'll get messed up inside because that's not what we're supposed to do. Okay.
We're not.
We act quite inappropriately in the middle of the page when we don't want to keep this in mind, when we don't keep this in mind in our relationship, even with little children. Let's say that we discover a shortcoming in a child, for example, that he cries, and instead of saying that this child is overcome by crying, we say he's a crybaby. That is, we put a label on him. And in this way, we unite the shortcomings with the child's very existence. He's saying that instead of saying there's something going on with this child, that they're crying for some reason, instead we call the child a crybaby. We name the child after a condition instead of dealing with the child as a person. We don't do this only to children, but also to ourselves. We often view these unseen forces, these sinful forces, as united with our existence, with our being. We identify with them. Top of page 15, he says. We do this to such a degree that we identify them with our being. And we don't want to give up our passions, our anger, our desires. We say, this is me. This comes from inside of me. And I don't want to let it go. It belongs to me. And we defend it. And if that's the way we're going to be, then we're going to cut ourselves off from other people and from God too. We do this, we can't see our existence as very good. We can't see it as being in the image of God. These ugly things come along and fasten themselves into us, got all tangled up. Now, he used the word I just used, tangled up with our inner life and our soul, especially that part that we're unaware of, that we're not conscious of. They don't. Because they have become part of our soul, start to be natural to our life. They are still foreign to our life, even though we identify with them. And he puts it like this: they don't cease as what they are to be foreign to our existence. They're still foreign to our existence. They are still results of the fall, but we make the mistake of identifying with them. A blending occurs, he says. Our soul, I'm jumping down five lines, our soul and all these negative things become one mixture, and we can't distinguish our soul as something that came out good, very good, from God. We think of the qualities of our soul as being the anger, the passion, the desire, the lust, the preference for ourselves, the rejection of others. We think of that as our soul. But those are things that are mixed into our soul, he's saying. They don't have any kind of existence on their own separate. They can go away, disappear. They don't exist on their own. It's our natural soul that has been created by God. But those things have become blended in with our soul into a mixture that we can't tell from our soul as it actually is, our good soul that God created. Okay, next paragraph, second sentence down in the middle. Okay, we have it. The great evil is when one doesn't understand that he has these things and he doesn't do what he's supposed to do to be delivered from them. So if we're identifying ourselves with all these things mixed in, then we're going to defend them. We're not going to fight against them. We're not going to be able to fight against them. Okay, next paragraph, third line down. Perhaps it could be that we'll be helped to be able to fearlessly and without preferring these passions, let's say, to see the reality that exists in us and not to hesitate to do what we must do, whatever sacrifice is required of us to be freed as much as possible from these foreign forces, from these cancers that exist in our psychosomatic constitution. So soul, flesh, psychosomatic body and soul. Body and soul are not meant to be separate. God created us as one being that is body and soul together. Psychosomatic, the understanding is that death is unnatural. It wasn't supposed to be there from the beginning. So if there is a disease here in our soul, it's going to affect the way our body lives. It's going to, what happens is that these passions lead the body. The soul is supposed to lead the body, but if the soul is confused and messed up, then it will lead the body without our even realizing it, because a lot of most of this is unconscious, in ways that are not good for us, that are self-destructive, that put a barrier between ourselves and other people, that put a barrier between us and God, and we will think, this is me, this is the real me, and we'll identify with it. And this is the kind of confused condition that is being described here by Elder Simeon, by Father Simeon. Okay. Clear? Not clear.
I think it's pretty clear.
Okay.
It does raise a question.
Okay.
About why, if we want to avoid identifying ourselves with these passions, why we so often in our prayers refer to ourselves as sinner, slothful.
Because we do it. Now, okay, remember when he said you shouldn't call the child a crybaby. When we say in our prayers that we are sinners, what we mean is that we are people who sin. We don't mean that to be a sinner is our nature. We sin. We do things that we ought not to do. That's what it means to be a sinner. To be a sinner doesn't mean that's just our nature. That's exactly what he's rejecting, saying that all of these things that are not good have been kneaded into the dough of our nature, but they're not part of our nature. They're not created by God. It's that we've been using our freedom in ways that makes this kind of labyrinth that he's talking about. The experiences in life we choose wrongly, that becomes part of us because what we do with our body passes into our mind, into our soul. It becomes kneaded in. So, but when we say we're sinners, we're not saying, you know, he said, well, that's what I am. I'm a sinner. Sometimes people who are converts and they think about sin in ways that are not orthodox, because when people who are not orthodox, most of them, when they say we are sinners, They mean that's the way we are. There's nothing we can do about it. Mm-hmm. There's no way that we can cooperate with God to trample down death, in other words, to trample down the temptation to sin that is drawing us into a way that's self-destructive. We say, no, God came into the world, destroyed the power of death over us, and we are able, if we desire God and to know God and to turn against this misunderstanding of ourselves as sinners by nature. You see, everything he's saying so far is rejecting that idea. Mm-hmm. Because this book is about trying to do something about that. So we say we are sinners in our prayers only because of the fact that we do, as a matter of fact, sin and we need help. By turning to God, that's what's going to give us the cooperation that we need so we don't just rely on ourselves. If we rely on ourselves, we're going to miss the mark. We're going to continue to sin, and we do. It's a spiritual struggle. Does that help?
It does. I think I've been confused about identifying with the sins. And
that's why I said in the sermon, and I thought, you know, gee, maybe I shouldn't have said that. But last week I said in the sermon that we are not created to grovel before God. To grovel, what does that mean? It means to, sometimes monks use words that sound like they are groveling. Can somebody else, what does grovel mean, to grovel? To lose your dignity, to lose any kind of self-respect, and just be willing to do anything no matter how low it is. Mm. That is not what God asks of us. You know, what I was trying to say in that sermon is that all human beings have the dignity of the fact that we are created to be like God. We're created in his image. You can't lose the fact that you're created in the image of God. Mm-hmm. And so there is such a thing as human dignity that all human beings have. It's not the idea that we have to be proud of ourselves. That's a problem. It's not pride. It's not lowering ourselves and our own understanding of ourselves to the point that we don't realize that God has created us for holiness. And we can't lose the fact that God has created us for holiness, even if we don't act as we ought to live, as we ought to act. That's why we treat everyone. You know, someone comes in to the church and they're not Orthodox, we may know, we may even recognize the person. Person who's done terrible things in the world. Would I skip that person sensing? No. I would sense that person along with the others because God created him in his own image and he can't lose that. In fact, man or woman that does terrible things, this is going to plague them because they've done something that is contrary to their created nature. I mean, that's where the conscience comes from. That's why it bothers us because we can act in ways that contradict what we are as human beings created in the image of God. Okay, so to say we're sinners, that means that we do things that are sinful. We miss the mark. But we can't lose the fact that we are created in the image of God and instead be something else, sinners.
I seem to have a problem where I say that I'm a sinner and then I'm just satisfied with it.
Yeah, well, it's a way out, so you don't have to do anything, right? If you're a sinner by nature, what can you do? There is a theology like that, but it's not ours. Mm-hmm. You don't get to get left off the hook. Mm-hmm. You can't lose the dignity of your having been created in the image of God. Okay, page 16 then. What we are deep down has great importance. Third sentence in, there is a great importance in what a human being is deep down. Every human being, each of us, it's important how we think deep down inside, how we move, how we act. I'm going to skip three sentences. The stance we take before the only reality, which is God. That's the central thing. And then in the presence of any other reality, we have to ask ourselves, is it the correct position, the correct stance, or not? So, now this business of the correct stance before God is what this whole section is about. We can say this, considering that we said some of the things we did last time. If we are taking the correct stance before God, there are three things that we're not doing. We are not attaching ourselves to someone else and complying with things that they would like us to do in order to have some sense of importance. We're actually using another person, not as a person, but as an object, because that's the way it is. You know, all three of these cases, we're moving towards someone. In other words, leaving our correct stance before God and not dealing with other human beings as people, but instead making them into something that we use to have a sense of importance or have some sense of who we are. We can do it in three different ways. We can attach ourselves to another person and go along with whatever they want to go along with, or we can move against other people and try to dominate them, and that gives us a sense of being in control, and the other person, again, just becomes an object that we use, no longer dealing with that person as a real person who has consciousness, depth, that depth that we talked last time about, or we can move away from others. Now, the problem with this is that we are isolating ourselves from others. And
again, you're making them an object.
Again, you're making them an object because you are moving away. You cannot be yourself in separation from others. We'll talk about that in the next heading, and that will become more clear. The heading that I have in mind is the one that starts on 24, that they may be one in us, that we are persons and not individuals. Now, if the meaning of my being myself, who I am, were about myself as an individual separate from others, that would be one thing. And most people today seem to believe that that's the way it is. You know, we talked a little bit about last time. But this is not an Orthodox Christian idea. It's an idea that developed in the 1500s. It has a history. It began in the Renaissance. It moved through the Reformation. It moved through the time when, in the 1700s, when the United States of America was founded, and the idea of individualism and humanism and putting God as secondary and getting him out of the way so that we can live life in this world and focus on this world and ourselves as the thing that really mattered. So this idea of individualism where everybody is independent of everybody else, it grew up, and now today it has taken over. But it is not a Christian idea. It does not begin with the Christian faith. It comes later. Our understanding is that in order for me to be myself, I can only do that as a member of all other human beings. Now, there was a brokenness that came into the world between human beings because of the fall. But with the coming of Christ, this is one of the things that he heals. He makes us all one with him as members of the body of Christ. Now, it's no Christianity if we think of ourselves as human beings separate from this oneness together of our humanity. And this idea has become very strange to people today. Mm-hmm. But without it, there's no Christianity. You cannot have Christianity without it. Not real Christianity. Instead, you have some way of, like Lewis would call it, Christianity in water. Mostly water, with just take a little drop with eyedroppers, take up a little bit of Christianity and drop it in. And then, you know, you can see it spread throughout the water. There's a little Christianity in there. Well, it's mostly water. It's mostly humanism. It's mostly human beings believing in themselves and in the world, with just a little tincture, just a little touch of Christianity running through it. That's not the Christian faith. There's no way to live like a Christian if that's our Christianity. So this individualism is the central problem today. People become Orthodox and they keep this idea and it blocks their spiritual life. So it's one of the most central things of most central importance in this book to deal with that. So those three ways are all ways of abandoning, of leaving behind the stance that is appropriate for human beings before God. And if we don't have the proper stance before God, then we're not going to have the proper stance before other human beings, other persons. Now, they may be messed up. They may have vices and shortcomings, but they were still created in the image of God, just like we were. So we can't judge them, we can't condemn them, because after all, we've been forgiven for the sins that we commit, and we want to maintain loyalty, maintain faithfulness to our oneness with them that we have because of Christ. That way we can have the proper stance before God. So I think you could say that the best way to have the proper stance before God is to turn away from the world, turn away from our self-love, and unite ourselves to Christ. Of course, that's a formula. It doesn't tell us as much as we need to learn by experience. But maybe it helps. Does that fit in with what we know of Christian faith? See how it works? One Christian, no Christian. Good grief, a Latin father said that. Wasn't even Greek. It was far enough back that he understood that. One Christian, no Christian. You cannot be a Christian alone. It's not possible. To be a Christian is to be one with others in Christ. No other possibility.
Where is the formula?
Oh, that formula's not in here. I just remembered that one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's, if I try, I can remember who said it. Let's see, Latin father. I'll have to put it in the request box, and you know, the answer will come out of my mouth later on. Like it did with Aaron Beck last week. Finally did remember it. Yeah, it was Tertullian, I think, that said that. Tertullian. He was a great bishop in Africa. Anyhow, there are two major sections that I would want to emphasize before the end of the section, and then we could just have a general discussion. So the last paragraph on page 17, bottom paragraph. From a spiritual viewpoint, I'd say deeper human existence doesn't take a correct position before the truth, before reality. As a consequence, when the character structure, the way our character is put together, the way we use our strategies, our three different strategies, whichever one is first, second, or third, as far as how we try to deal with the world, becomes our character because we continue to do it all the time. If it works, we keep doing it. Different strategies as far as moving toward others, moving against others, or moving away from others. Different strategies work best for different people. Doesn't mean they don't use the other ones, they do. We keep doing it because it's what works and it becomes part of our character. Because anything you keep doing becomes part of your character. Pagans knew that. You want to have a better character? Start doing the things you ought to do. Your character will improve. It will become habitual. But if we are habitually doing things because we are forced to, because of these things that we become used to doing, moving against others, moving toward others, and just being a follower, going along, being the kind of the official sidekick, you know, for somebody. Some people like to have somebody that is the leader, and they follow that person. That person doesn't work out. They glom on somebody else, or they go it alone, you know, and just, you know, keep everybody at an arm's length. That becomes their character structure. When the character structure is controlled by things that we are not aware of, in other words, neurotic, then those trends or tendencies are created and they are self-governing. They act on their own. We don't have control of them. And we have compulsive drives, anxiety, and all the confusion that contemporary human beings live through and can't sort out because it's all tangled up inside and we don't know about most of it. He doesn't know what's happening to him, and he doesn't find or see any way out. The deeper reason, then, is the neurotic character structure, which has been created, as we explained, on account of our unsound stance before the truth and before reality, because we've made up ways of strategically dealing with life as though there were no God, as though we weren't created in his image, and as though others weren't created in his image either. But we're just trying to function in the fallen world in a way that works for us. And it's become habitual. It's become our character. In society, reality is what it is. If someone doesn't take a correct position before reality, if he doesn't have the ability, the capacity to take a correct position, if he didn't learn to take a correct position, to be sure, he'll get all tangled up. Somewhere his gears will get caught. That's what happens when you try to cast. And the gear catches and it goes, it pulls back, the line pulls back, and then you have this rat's nest in your line, right? That's how it gets tangled up. So somewhere his gears will get caught. Somewhere he'll get mixed up. And from that point on, the person's neurotic symptoms will begin. Okay, we're all people who live in the 20th century. Well, now we live in the 21st century. And we have the civilization we have and the knowledge we have, and we're stuck with it, more or less. It's outside of ourselves. But after all, no one is a sound human being. I'm not, you're not, nobody is. We're all tangled up one way or another. But we're all responsible to deal with it. We have freedom. The Son of God has come, did destroy the power of death over us, and we don't have to be controlled by the presence of things that turn toward death instead of Christ and make us all tangled up. There are ways that can be dealt with if that's what we want. We ourselves are victims of ourselves, but as long as we're in that condition, we also make victims of others. Okay, so that's that I think are some of the most important things in that section, and that's all the further I ask people to read. And we can talk about any of that if people would like. For next time, we can go on 19 through 23. So we're not blasting through.
No hurry.
What do you think?
That's about the shape of it.
Blocks are in our way that are going to keep us from actively engaging in spiritual life. As long as we're all tangled up, we're not going to be able to do it well. So this is before an active engagement in spiritual life. It's headed in that direction, and that's why I compared it with the NA program, because in NA they say, look, you're not ready for a spiritual life yet. This is your spiritual life is to get untangled. Right now you're being controlled by this drug, whatever it is, drug or alcohol or whatever it is. You've got to deal with that first. Once you're not controlled by these impulses, by these forces that have robbed you of your freedom, then you can begin the spiritual life of the Orthodox Christian faith. But until then, you're not ready. This, I think, is similar to that, is what he's saying to us. We are not being able to pursue the spiritual life because of our messed up internal condition. Now, we're not going to be like Christ, Christ-like, or deified once we get this mess sorted out. We'll only be at the point that now we can actually begin to love God, love others, and move toward Christ without being blocked.
So how do we see the blockages we have?
Well, we'll get it little bit by little bit. People will recognize them to one degree or another. And I'll tell you how to tell. When you want to reject something that's been said, if you want to find some kind of argument to defend against what's being said, then you know you found one. Mm-hmm. We all will. We all start making excuses to defend our tangled up condition because that's what we've been depending on. We make excuses to defend our strategy that's been successful for us and has given us a certain sense of being able to deal with things. That's our identity, our false identity. We made an idol of that. It works for us, and we're not going to want anybody to touch it. We will run into that.
So
you'll be able to tell.
What is character, then, when you're reading this other book and having
The Road to Character.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I like that book is because we're talking about David Brooks' book, The Road to Character. It's not like a prescription to improve the character of a person whose character is not good. That's not what it is. I've been recommending it to people, and they may sometimes be offended. You know, say, like, it's maybe is Father Jacob saying, well, I have bad character, and Father Jacob has given me this book so that I can improve it. Well, it's not that kind of a book. The other book, years and years ago, that I recommended to people, Character is Destiny, it was more that kind of a book. But this one isn't. What this book does is each chapter uses the example of someone who has fought some kind of a struggle to develop character and to live a life that is based on a character that they have made strong. And in the life of each person who is an example, it's a different constellation, to use the word we used last week, of character. That's why I like it, because you know they're different people. One of them is General Eisenhower, and another one is A. Philip Randolph. I love that part on A. Philip Randolph, because A. Philip Randolph was a black activist in the 60s who was one of the people who was actually responsible for the March on Washington, more so than Dr. King, who was the star, no question about it. But behind Dr. King, there were other people who organized, and one of them was this A. Philip Randolph. A. Philip Randolph organized Pullman workers in trains back in the 1920s. I mean, he was an old man by the time of the 1960s in the March on Washington. But this was a man that had a character that was just, everybody trusted him. Everybody knew that he could not be bought, he could not be influenced, you could count on him. There was nothing that was going to change him. He was absolutely dependable. He just had a character that was separate from the things that we ordinarily depend on in life and in the world. A part of the development of character has to do with discipline. Well, there's a chapter on discipline in the book. I think it might have been Marshall, George Marshall, General Marshall, the chapter that was about him, and how he used the development of military discipline, military school and in the army, so that he could count on himself to do whatever was necessary. He didn't depend on his passions, desires. He just was completely a person of character. So character in different people is not going to be the same, is not going to be identical. But one of the things that you can say in general is that character is established by practice. What you do establishes the way you are inside. To begin with, there are certain principles that are moral, that are cut across the board, that apply to everyone. But you'll find that different people are shaped in their lives not by the same primary things, not by the same primary virtues. Similar to the way that there can be some people who are in this book. I mean, everybody's got something different to deal with. Father Schmemann used to say, it's a matter of dealing with the hand that you've been dealt. So we're all different inside. We have a different background, heritage, body. Our bodies are going to respond differently. Our passions, we're going to be more susceptible to some passions than others. And if we're susceptible to a particular passion, that passion could dominate our lives. And so the character development for that person could very well have to do with dealing with that particular passion or vice, and using discipline and developing a habitual commitment to the virtue that is opposite of that vice. It won't be the same for everybody, because some people are not moved by certain vices. In the beginning, in the introduction to St. John Climacus' book, The Ladder of Divine Ascent, the introduction that I'm thinking of is the introduction that was written by Lazarus Moore. His translation is what I have in mind. He talks about how, and he finds this in St. John of the Ladder, there are some virtues that for some of us just happen all by themselves. Some people might be loving and affectionate. It just seems to come out of them. But what Lazarus Moore and St. John Climacus say, that some of these things that seem like virtues are fed by evil springs, like Irma Bombeck, her book, "The Grass is Always Greenest Over the Septic Tank." You know, never heard that. It's too long ago.
I've heard it, but it's not true.
Why would you say that?
Because the septic tank is a piece of concrete not very far under the ground. So when it gets a dry season, that's the first thing that dries up and dies.
I guess we're talking about a cracked septic tank.
Yeah, she must have a cracked septic tank.
She must have.
Might be over the grass is always greener over the
sewage drain field.
Drain field.
Well, that's the way she put it, though. And the idea is that there may be things that are not good that are feeding this virtue. But under this virtue, that it's a kind of a public thing that everybody can see, oh, this person is so good. But they may have some other vice that nobody knows about. Well, how could that be? Because they're so good in this particular way. And we do all seem to have some ways in which there are some vices that just don't move us. People are different. So I think character has to take that into account if you're going to talk about character, which is one of the reasons I like that book. So yeah, I recommend it.
Well, I guess that you're talking about character, but what is character? Character is the in these terms that he's putting up here. Well, conscious, subconscious, or unconscious. Would character be conscious development?
One person has said that character is the way you act when nobody's looking.
I'm saying that.
Mm-hmm. It's something that needs to be developed. People are born with personality. They're not born with character. The Greeks had a whole system of developing character. It was called paideia. And the root word of paideia has to do with the child, pediatrics. But paideia, the Greek paideia, was the treatment, the training that is necessary for a human child in order that that child become a human being. Their idea was that if you have no developed character, you are not going to live as a human being, as is appropriate for a human being to live. It has to be learned. It's just not just born like that. If a boy or girl grows up in the jungle, feral, like a feral cat, they're not going to have character. They will still have personality. You know, but they won't have character, because character is something that has to be learned. It has to be taught. It has to be taught by mothers, fathers, family, society. Our society confuses personality and character. They don't distinguish it very well. I heard just an example on the news here just today. Somebody said, you know, watching the vice presidential debate, that Cain and Pence had very different characters. They didn't mean character. They meant personality, but they said character, because people say character for personality all the time. Character development is not real popular. Like it has become more popular. I have more people in ethics this semester than I've ever had before. Ethics has become a hot topic. You know, if you look around, you see why. You know, I've never had more people in ethics than in world religion until this semester. It's an event.
Wow.
So what is character? Character is the strength to act morally. In other words, it's not just knowing the right thing to do. It's having the strength to be able to do it. So that is part of character. And that strength to be able to do what ought to be done includes having dealt with all of the things inside of a person that would move them to do what ought not to be done. Human beings are each responsible for their own moral lives, not in isolation, along with all of the other human beings, but we act on our own. We choose and act and move around as the persons that we are. But it's not something that is uniquely Christian. The pagans knew all about it. Civilization is not possible without character.
I'm sorry.
I don't have you don't need to be sorry. It's a good question.
I'm just kind of confused about lots of different things.
He did use the word character.
We're coming from different books talking about vice and virtues and and talking about the soul, and we've studied a lot of different books, and, and they've approached these topics, it seems. It's the same topic, and they're saying a lot of the same things, but they're approaching it in a different way, and it's just kind of a hard to figure out.
Well, you know? Don't you do that. Just gets, focus on the...
You can get confused, I think. To me, I feel like I get confused when I think about this stuff. To be able to integrate. I guess what I'm saying is, if we're studying this, and he's... And we're supposed to be assuming that what he's saying is useful and right and, and correct. And somebody else is saying something else.
Who's saying something else?
Well, like the book, Layman in the Desert, you know. When he
what is he saying?
I don't know.
It was different.
Well, he wasn't, he was just talking about virtues and vices.
Yeah, he was. I think they fit together.
Yeah. Okay. But you... We're not saying that one is wrong or one is
no.
Or the other is better than the other. Or
I don't see how they conflict.
Okay. All right.
Does anybody else?
Well, I do feel like I get lost a little bit, but
it's a new book.
It's hard, you know, sometimes to really grasp it all, but
it'll become more second nature as time goes on, I think.
So. How would you describe the significance of character within a spiritual life?
A person of weak character is not going to be able to follow through with their part, our human part, of doing what needs to be done. Hmm. Now, it's difficult. A person of character, if you have... It's interesting. You know, once you've developed strength of character, it gives you more freedom to work on things that are not as they ought to be inside of you. You have the strength to be able to see, this is how it ought to be, this is not how I am, but I choose the godly path, even though it's difficult. And since you've already built up a good strong arm, you're going to be able to put it to that task and follow through with it. Even though it's, you know, going to have temptations to continue to do it the way you've habitually been doing it. Now you've decided this particular thing that I've done in the past is not virtuous. It needs to be changed. Well, it's one thing to say it needs to be changed. It's another thing to be able to have the strength of character to cooperate in synergy with God in order to hold up your part. God will not force us. He will not somehow give us the magical ability to no longer be tempted by whatever it is that we've gotten used to having that is not good for us. Part of what I'm doing here, and this fits in with this book perfectly well, is assuming that character is something that can be developed and to a certain degree needs to be developed before you begin to be successful in engaging in the spiritual life in a way that goes beyond simply the development of character. Mm-hmm. Father Schmemann used to say that a decent person, it's the least you can expect. We have the idea that it's a great accomplishment. You know, it takes the intervention of God for me to be a decent human being. That's not true. We can contradict our habits and go against them on the basis of our own strength of character development. And if we don't, we're probably not going to be very good at the kind of spiritual life that the Christian faith demands. I had a book that I almost brought tonight just to kind of say, hey, here is this nice book. It's a book that I want to read that I haven't had a chance to read, but I want to read it. I know what's in it, but it's good for me to read it anyway. It's called The Porch and the Cross. And the porch, in Greek, porch is stoa. And it's where the philosophers met, on the porch. And those philosophers were called Stoics. And Stoics were Greek and Roman, particularly Roman, philosophers who focused on the development of character and strength of character. The early Christians liked them a lot. A lot of them became Christians because they saw the fulfillment of their philosophy in Christianity. So there's a relationship between the Stoics and Christianity.
What is that, like calling them the porch people?
Yeah. Those who met on the porch. The Stoics. And you know what Stoic means. A person who is Stoic. We think of Indians as Stoic. Anyway, okay, thank you.